Hello, guys. Welcome to the Blackspin Global Podcast. I am Lucy.
And I'm Eugene.
And welcome to a brand new episode. And today, it's kind of different.
It is.
Not really a pod. We kind of have like a special guest, maybe.
Kind of, sort of.
We have tennis coach John Williams. How are you, John?
I'm doing well.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, much appreciated, man. Thank you for having me.
I think you're like the first, no, second, actually.
We had studio Tamani. Guest.
Yes, studio guest. But to be fair, do we call Tamani a guest?
I mean, I was going to say, this is our first interview.
You're actually the proper first guest.
Exactly.
Ooh. Yes.
Special.
Nice. Special.
Nice. Very, very special.
Thank you so much for having me. It is indeed a pleasure to join you today.
No, so it's great, man. I'm very happy and excited for this interview. Like, can't wait to get into it. So
awesome.
We should get in. Let's start.
All right. So let's just actually start from like the beginning. So like, give us a little bit about your background. Obviously, like people who don't really know you. Who's John Williams?
Ooh. How much time do we have? So I started in the fitness industry back in 1995.
Oh, wow.
And quickly, I'm gonna leapfrog a little bit through the timeline because we could be here for a while. So started in 95, started out basically sitting at the desk in a gym at a country club on the North Shore of Long Island, where the average age of the people that came to the gym was like 72. Mm. So I knew nothing about the industry. I had been physically active pretty much all of my life. So I had bro knowledge and gym knowledge, but I never coached anybody. And once I got into that position, I started thinking, you know, hey, I could do some pretty cool stuff here. The entire reason I got that job was I was still racing motorcycles professionally at the time.
Wow. Mm.
And in the off season, I needed some way to fund my addiction because it wasn't paying very well. Mm. So this provided me with a structured schedule. I worked from 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. So I had the entire rest of the day to do what I needed to do. It wasn't dangerous. And basically, it was mindless work. So I could handle my other business. And I didn't know it at the time, but it gave me a tremendous amount of time to be able to read and educate myself. And I did that for about 5 years, actually. And in the sixth year, I opened my first facility. So I was now working both places and I was still racing. And it was pretty crazy at that point. Mm.
Wow.
Pretty crazy.
What were you racing? Was it like Moto Cross or Moto GP?
Moto GP style.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah, knee down, dragging in the corners, the real stuff.
Like, what got you into that?
A childhood dream. Oh. Yeah, I was always in love with motorcycles for some reason, like probably most kids are. And I didn't know like motorcycle racing was a thing. I loved bikes. And when I got to, I would say probably the age of like 17, 18, for the first time I saw a road race on TV. Because I was never a big like television watcher. Yeah. I've always been into movies and stuff. Mm. But I never really spent a whole bunch of time watching TV. And I just happened to catch it. And I was like, wow, that's incredible.
Wow.
I'm going to do that one day. No clue how, if, when, knew nothing about it. Didn't know how to get started, didn't even know where the racetracks were, like zero knowledge. And 3 years later, I'm doing my first race.
That's incredible. Because I had no idea that that was a thing in America.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Because I know NASCAR is big, but.
Oh my goodness. Don't get me started.
Yeah. I mean, we won't. We're here for the tennis. But no, that's very interesting, John. That's so fascinating.
That's where I started. And then, you know, leapfrogging again through the timeline. So ended up leaving New York where I began and moved to Georgia. Opened up a few facilities there. Fast forward, it's 2006 or so. I'm preparing a football player for the NFL Combine. And the owner of the gym that we are training at says, hey, I own this tennis club just down the road. The head coach there is working with this young girl who's going to be a good player. You should go talk to him because he could really use a guy like you. Ended up meeting with him. His name was Greg. Met with Greg. Greg happened to be working with a young lady named Grace. Grace went on to win the US Open Juniors in 2017, I believe. Mm. And I had been working with Grace since she was 10.
Wow.
Somewhere around year two of working with her, her reputation and ranking nationally started to climb, and then became, and I became a magnet for working with junior tennis players. Mm. So that's how all of that began. But it was on the fitness side. Of course, being around tennis as much as I was, because in addition to the fitness, the like quote unquote in gym stuff, the movement mechanics and the way that I see things and the way that I coach things was very, very different at the time. And that allowed me and required me to spend a tremendous amount of time on court as well. And while I was on court, hearing the coaching, being around that environment, you know, I just absorb things and see what works and what doesn't. And it just adds to my library. So
fascinating.
Fast forward, 2015, actually before that, 2008, 2009, started working with Donald Young Jr., traveled with him a bit in 2009, went to the US Open with him, just kept working with him off season sporadically. Now my kind of echelon of player kept climbing. The age group got a little bit older, started doing a lot more off-season college, you know, university work with players and pro-level players. Then 2015, I traveled with him again for pretty much every slam except the Open. And the only reason I missed that one was because my house caught on fire.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, it was a crazy story. But so I missed that one, but we did all the slams together, and that was the US Open year where he made that amazing run and pretty much was Superman in the heat. And we had basically geared, I structured his entire training program that year toward peaking at the US Open and for the US Open. And when I presented it to him, this will give you a little bit of insight into my mindset. I said something along the lines of, you know, I want you to be prepared to play 3.5 hours at 95% in 95 degree temperature. When you can do that physically, you're ready, because nobody else is going to be able to do that. And sure enough, you look at the temperatures, you look at how long his matches went. I mean, that wasn't the design. The design was not to have the matches go that long, but but they did. But he survived, and it was a battle of attrition for most of the other players.
Fascinating.
So, yeah, and then it just progressed from there.
So would you say tennis was always a sport you wanted to get into, or it kind of happened by accident?
Yes, it definitely happened by accident. So when I moved to Georgia, I kind of took a hiatus because I had been involved in the fitness industry and the performance industry for so long, and like in a variety of sports, like everything from motorsport to, you know, military to law enforcement to even exotic dancers at one point. They were like, my client base was very, very diverse. But the one sport that I hadn't worked with in depth was tennis players. And when I had that separation from the work requirements, from the day-to-day, I was able to sit down and actually watch this. So this time frame was when Federer was really on his ascent, and he was just mopping people up left and right.
Lucy's goat.
And I watched, for sure. And I watched him, and I was like, wow. If I were a tennis player, that's who I would want to be. Like that, that's who I would aspire to. Knew very little about the aspects of playing tennis, but I'm looking at how efficient he's moving, how effortlessly he's executing, and his mindset and his body language. And those things immediately jumped out to me. The tennis knowledge and IQ came later, right? When I started putting pieces together. But I looked at that and I was like, wow, it's got everything I like. Because I did play racquetball competitively, which is a racket sport, and it's one-on-one. it's a lot like cage fighting, actually, because you're trapped in a box. Mm. So I saw that and I was like, man, that'd be pretty cool, because I haven't done a lot of work with them. But I was, you know, I kind of had this football thing going on, and I started to work a lot more with track and field athletes. And so it just kind of serendipitously fell when the gym owner introduced me to Greg, and that just kind of exploded from there.
Fascinating. And with Donald Young, Donald was a junior number one.
He was.
So when did you start work? What age was he when you started working with him?
That's a great question. I want to say he was probably 19, okay. 18, 19, I think.
So just basically starting his journey on the pro tour.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Exactly.
Wow. And yeah, if you can talk a bit more about kind of that experience, like working with him and like, yeah, basically traveling with him, like to these pro events, like how was that for you? And yeah, what can you remember like of that time?
My focus was very narrow at the time, because again, I was brought in to handle the physical stuff. So, you know, in terms of philosophy, the first thing I view it like the Hippocratic Oath in medicine. The first thing is you have to do no harm. So in my analytical process, I'm looking at where are the potential points of failure? Where are you going to break down? Where are you on the ragged edge right now? Because that's what we need to address immediately before we start looking at anything else. So let's shore up the foundation, and then we can start building. So with Donald, he had a couple of things physically that for me were like in the red zone, glaring areas of potential problems, flexibility, nutrition. Those two jump out immediately. So I wanted to address those. There were some range of motion issues, some mobility issues, and then there was a deficiency in strength. Because of the nature of the sport, every player has muscle imbalances. Every athlete has muscle imbalances. This just became, you know, more obvious when you're in a one-sided sport. And looking at those things, that was where I was focused. So when we were in the gym at home, those were the primary areas of centralization. And then when we were traveling, it was how do we keep moving the needle in the direction that we want while not compromising the ability to perform when you're on court.
Fascinating. Was Chris Eubanks also like in the scene at that time? Because I know he was a hitting partner.
Yes. So 2009, no, I did not know Chris. Then 2015, yes, actually. And I don't remember if off air we were talking about this, but 2015, the first time I came to Wimbledon was with Chris. Chris joined Donald and was here hitting with him. And we went to Nottingham. And I remember a lot of the other pro players, you know, on the men's side, a lot of the other ATP guys were looking at Chris like, who's this kid? Because he was, you know, he was ripping the ball, and obviously he's tall. Mm. So they were, you know, he was a fresh face with some unique attributes.
Yeah.
And
shouts out to Chris.
Yeah.
Shouts out to Wimbledon quarterfinalist.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Amazing performance, and couldn't be happier for him. Indeed. Because you know he's a great guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy. So it's and we can talk about that a little bit later. But the power of belief is amazing. Mm-hmm. But the power of awareness and awakening is even bigger than that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that was 2015 when Chris joined, and we had a chance to spend some time together. Actually, on our day off, we actually did some sightseeing in Wimbledon, in London, in central London. So nice. That was pretty cool.
Oh, fantastic.
And like, how did you actually get to work it with Taylor Townsend, who you're actually like coaching
right
now?
That's a pretty interesting story as well. So Taylor and I have been working together on and off since 2013.
Oh, wow.
Is when we started.
Okay.
And she doesn't like when I tell this story, so I'm going to tell it.
Sorry, Taylor.
Sorry.
So we started working together in 2013. She came back to Atlanta and reconnected with Donald Young Sr. And she was looking for a fitness guy. Mm-hmm. So my name came up and we started working together. we traveled. I traveled to the French Open with Donald Jr., but Taylor was also playing the French that year. So we figured out a good working arrangement, and we had already been working together for a bit just before that, but not a long time. And maybe we did like a handful of sessions, something like that. And I beat her up pretty handily. But she's a, contrary to a lot of speculation, she's an extremely hard worker, which you guys can see the result of her hard work. Now, 100%. What was missing in the past was a very effective direction and from people of guidance, right? And her understanding of what her true goals were. But so we were working together for a little bit back then. We get to the French and I'm meeting Taylor in the gym for a session. We're going to do a quick cardio session, what is now commonly known as HIIT. Mm. And she comes down and she's like, hey, I decided I'm going to go in a different direction with my fitness. So thank you for everything.
Oh, you really made it work, huh?
So that's basically me getting fired at the French Open, like our sixth session in. So I'm like, oh, okay.
So this was actually in Paris?
This is in Paris, oh, wow. At the hotel, the hotel gym. So that was the end of that for that time period.
Okay.
We reconnected, and I want to say 2015 or 16. No, it was probably 2016, 17. Mm. She called me up and said, hey, I want to start working with you again. And I was like, I've been down that road before. Why would I want to start working with you? And she said some things that were very, let's just put it like this. It was the right things to say.
Okay.
Okay. But I'm the type of person that I don't really care what you say. I'm more interested in what you do. So I said, okay, well, come to the gym. Here's the address. Sit down. We'll have a discussion. Look me in my eyes while you're sitting across from me and tell me what your goals are and why you want me to be involved. Mm. And if I feel what I need to feel, mm-hmm. we're good. Mm-hmm. If I don't, mm-hmm. we'll just stay phone friends and that'll be that. So that's how we started working together again on the fitness thing. So let's just say, for timeline's sake, this was around 2017. And then preparing her for the US Open was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, she busted her butt big time. We accomplished a lot in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And that was largely due to her commitment to the process. So that went on, obviously, you know, 17, 18, 19. Whenever she was in town, she was back in the gym. So that was really the formation of the actual relationship. Right. That's when we actually put reps in and got to know each other, got to understand, you know, her body and how things were working and her mm-hmm. limitations and so on and so forth. We also got clear on, you know, physical goals. All right. So now she gets pregnant and there's a change in her coaching relationship. Mm. She comes to me on the physical side, tells me that she's pregnant. And she's like, hey, I need you to help me get through this. So I said, okay, no problem. I got you. So I put together the meal plan, the supplementation, you know, kind of gave her a heads up because I'm a father of two, three, if you count my dog. But, you know, kind of gave her a heads up on what to expect as a pregnant person.
Yeah.
And some things that she can do as an athlete to kind of get ahead of that, be able to maintain and then help the comeback. Mm. So that was the plan. It was just, for me, it was just another project. Okay. So instead of, you know, Wimbledon performance, we need to plan for a pregnancy performance. Mm. And I just shifted the mindset to everything there. Here's what you need to stay away from. Here's what you need to make sure you keep doing, blah, 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 blah. So as we, you know, go through this process, again, she's not really a competitive athlete anymore at this point in time because now she's taken time off. There's whole COVID thing that's, you know, so nobody's playing tennis. And it was an ideal time for her to have a child because there wasn't, like, she wasn't really missing anything.
That's true,
So it just worked out serendipitously. And we got her through that process. And now, you know, Aiden's born, Taylor's working her way back. We're working her way back to full fitness, or at least to the point where we can start training hard again. And she wants to get back on court. So she's like, hey, I want to start doing, like, I want to take this time to really work on the things that I wasn't ever really good at. I was like, oh, okay. So we start doing some movement stuff and I'm like, hey, do you, you know, I start asking her questions and she comes to me and was like, hey, you know a lot about this tennis stuff. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe. I mean, I've been around it for a long time. I understand some things. And she's like, let's keep going. So we do more stuff. And now she's able to, like, we're getting her up to speed. And like now she can go through a couple of baskets of balls, you know, without getting winded and, and feeling like she's going to die. And I'm asking her questions about her level of understanding. And if you guys have seen Taylor comment on the tennis channel and things like that, you know, her tennis IQ is really, really high. But there were some things missing, like on her side. And those were the things that became obvious to me when I asked her these questions. So we worked on those things and she saw the results. And eventually that conversation led to, hey, I want you to coach me. And then I was like, well, you know, I live in Portugal. And she's like, yeah, I understand. We can figure out a way to make it work if, you know, if you're interested. And I said, okay, well, let me, give me some time to figure out what this looks like on my side. And I went and talked to my family. And first I said, what do you guys think? Like, how do you guys feel about this? They gave me their feedback. I went back to Taylor and I said, okay, listen, first I have to tell you where I know my limitations exist. And if that's okay with you, cool, we can continue the discussion. If it's not okay with you, I completely understand. I'm not a tennis player, so I don't hit balls. If that's what you need, I'm not the guy. Like, I can't help you with that. I can't fill that role. And there were a couple of other things that I listed. And I said, but here's what I can do. And I gave her that list. And I said, you have to decide whether or not that's acceptable. She said, yes. And that's how the relationship began.
Fascinating. Because, I mean, again, that just shows, obviously, it's a different relationship compared to the Donald Young relationship to Taylor Townsend. So you were more than just a fitness coach. You were, well, you're essentially a tennis coach.
Right.
So, like, how has that been for you now as well? Like, in terms of, you know, your background isn't, like you said, you never played tennis, but now you're a pro player's coach.
Right.
So, like, how challenging has that been for you?
Yeah, so interesting little connection there. Funny little tidbit about me. I love challenges. So, and I love learning. So what I look at when I am in these situations, because it's not the first time, like, I never coached a track and field long jumper either. But when I was, when I had one show up for me to coach, I did well. And they went out and qualified for a world championship. Why? Well, first of all, they had the ability. Second of all, I had the understanding of physically what needed to be done. But thirdly, I understand physics. I understand mechanics. I understand, you know, kinesiology. I understand the principles of movement. All that was left was understanding the specifics of the sport. And that's where most people, and I'm not throwing stones at anybody, but that's where most people leave off. They understand the mechanics and the details of the sport, and that's it. So everything outside of that sphere gets neglected or gets entrusted to others. The entire reason I started in the physiotherapy, you know, injury recovery sector was because the people that I had doing the job at the time were not doing the job. They were not doing a very good job. I would get athletes back that were injured, and they were still injured. They still had deficiencies, but mm-hmm. these people said that they were good to go. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, where's the disconnect? Mm-hmm. So I figured out how to bridge the gap and actually get them ready and good to go. When I started the nutrition thing, I sent people to nutritionists, and they're still talking about drink milk and eat eggs and, you know, the bottom base of the food pyramid in the US, which is atrocious. It's terrible. So you're telling me that this competitive athlete who I sent to you with 10% body fat a month later now has 13% body fat, but they're eating healthy, in your opinion. No, you don't get it. Like that's not how it works. So I had to figure out nutrition as well. And the way that I approach that is the same way I approach everything else. I found that I find the gold standard in the domain, and then I look for the commonalities. So when it came to tennis, I was already watching Federer. You can't get higher than gold standard than that, right? Now, we could argue as to whether or not he's the best player in the world, but we can't argue with how smooth and fluid he is on court, how efficient he is on court. We can't argue with, look at the longevity of the career, right? There's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. And Rafa, much respect due to him, incredible, incredible competitor, incredible player, incredible legacy. But if you had to pick one, who do you think is going to be in better physical shape, right? Just walking around when they're 70. You'd have to say Roger.
Yeah, 100%.
Right?
Yeah.
Novak, what created and contributed to his meteoric rise? He changed his mindset surrounding his body.
Yeah.
LeBron spends $1 million every year plus, right? And now he's not the only one. There's a couple of stories that came out. They understand that if you play a sport, your body is your tool.
Yeah.
You take care of the tool, the machine, then you can play the sport longer and better. Okay.
It's funny because Lucy and I were saying this morning how like fitness is basically a lifestyle for a lot of, well, for someone like Lucy, for instance. So I think a lot of athletes kind of fall into that category as well.
Yeah. And I even said that thing about Djokovic, which I said to you, I don't know if I said it on the pod or offline, but I said one of the things that he stands out from a lot of other players, he does not joke about his body. Like, he's always been like, you know, talking about like the importance of taking care of it. And I love how you've implemented that into Taylor's like mind as well, because we've seen the difference since you guys have actually been working together. And even when you guys shared how you've been working together during our live, was it next year?
Last year.
Yeah. And how, like, although it was intense, it was the way she was saying, I was like, boy, I would never want to train with this man in my life. But it was worth it. It definitely was. Because you see the result like now, 100%. But it's really dope.
Also as well, I think it's important, like what's the differences between working with a male athlete and a female athlete? And especially like you've been with Taylor through the pregnancy,
right?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That must have been quite challenging for you as well, in terms of a pro athlete trying to get her back in shape to go back on tour. Like, yeah, if you can talk a bit about the kind of challenges there.
Absolutely. First, you know, when we talk about working with someone who's pregnant, I will have to give a huge shout out to my wife, because when she was pregnant with our first, her transition back was my master's degree. That was my education. Obviously, throughout the entire process, I was there. So supplementation while she was pregnant. So everything that I learned in that 9-month, 11-month period, I was able to then call upon for future, you know, for future reference. And of course, as information became much more prevalent, science was updated, I updated myself along the years and the process. So by the time Taylor came, I had you know, four or five athletes that had already gone through that. So I had a kind of a track record of experience and a knowledge base that I felt comfortable drawing from. Now, everybody is different, but we all have the same physiology, right? Mm. So the fundamental commonalities remain the same. Learning what I had learned working with an athlete who was going through a pregnancy and then with the intention of coming back to physical activity, it became super simple for her because it was like, okay, well, you're going to gain a lot of weight. So how are we going to manage that on the flip side while you are still nursing? Mm-hmm. Because you need to understand that we can't pull and push at the same time. Yeah. You have to be willing to understand and sacrifice for timeline. So what does that mean? That means, first of all, give yourself more time than you think you need. You want to come back in a year, give yourself two. Mm. Don't even start thinking anything less than 24 months. Because if it happens faster, great. If it takes a month or two longer, who cares? But don't put yourself under pressure. Take the time. Enjoy your son.
Yeah.
Be a mother. Enjoy your time away. Because when it's go time, it's going to be hell.
Which one is what happened?
It is. Yeah. And I spent a lot of time reinforcing that level of awareness and understanding so that her expectations were managed. Mm. When your expectations are managed, it's like going to the gym for, Eugene, we go to the gym for a week and you're like, John, you know, I haven't put 3 inches on my biceps. I'm not able to run that marathon yet. And I'm like, dude, it's been 3 weeks. Where were your expectations? You know, that's where the problems come into play. Mm. So I spent that time channeling her understanding and tempering her expectations. So that when we got into that, it was like, hey, it was a good week. Mm. She's like, why was it a good week? I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And didn't. Yeah, you did. You showed up. You executed. It was a good week. On to the next. Mm. Get ready for next week. Right. And I also, you know, kind of shared with her a chunk at a time because you can't give Taylor too much information. And that's the same with most athletes. They only need to know as much as they need to know. And that's very personality dependent as well. But in building that, she got to understand that and take trust and comfort in that, knowing that I had a plan and that the plan was working. She may not know the plan. She may not understand the plan. As a matter of fact, if you talk to her right now, if you got her on the phone and said, hey, what do you have, like, what does John have planned for the next, you know, 4 weeks? I don't know. I just show up, you know? That's what she would say. Mm. And, but I do have a plan, and I did have a plan, and through working the plan, she got a chance to see and develop comfort in knowing that she had, you know, someone on her team that was consistently reliable and ahead of where she was. So that when we ran into roadblocks, hey, this week I didn't lose any weight. Okay. You're not worried? No. Why? Well, because that's what the body does. Mm. Sometimes it seeks equilibrium and you might go through, you know, 4 weeks where you're dropping pounds like crazy and then you just kind of plateau for a bit. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's okay. It's not going to last. Mm. We'll just keep doing what we're doing. The body will get back on page and boom. And sure enough, that's how it went. So it went like that through the entire time back. You know, even when she was back on court and starting to compete, she was like, yeah, I'm still not at our weight goal. And I was like, really? What was our weight goal? You know, because I never gave you a hard number. Mm. I said, let's see where your body sets naturally. Mm. When we feed it right, when we rest it well, when we challenge it physically, let's see where you end up naturally, and then we'll make an adjustment from there. And that's how it went. Now, getting to the second part of your question, male versus female athletes. This is going to probably be a bit controversial.
We're ready.
But I'm fine with that.
This is Black Spin Global. Okay.
So this question was asked to me, I think the first time probably in 2010 or so, when I sat on a panel of, because I used to chair the Center for Sports Parenting, which at the time was this organization. I don't even know if they still exist, but at the time was this organization dedicated toward educating parents of athletes as to how to be better parents to their athletes. We could certainly use a lot more of that now, but this question was asked like, you know, what are the differences when you're working with male and female athletes? Inherently, female athletes want to please if they trust you. And trust, in quotations, means they have to understand that you are completely dedicated to helping them and their well-being. Once they understand that, generally, female athletes will want to do things that please you. They want to make you happy. Okay? Male athletes are hard-headed, they're stubborn, and they're hugely ego-driven. Mm. Now, those are the huge, and again, I'm making broad generalizations here, but those are the huge dividers between the two, between male and female. Now, obviously, it's a spectrum, okay? But generally speaking, those are the two segments. If you know how to handle both or handle each, then you can get the best out of each. When I'm working with male athletes, if they're really ego-driven, then depending on the environment. So, for example, when I'm working with MMA fighters, they're extremely ego-driven. They're willing to go through the fire to prove to you how tough they are. You can easily use that to get that extra 1.5% out of them. So when they're on a bike and they're near death from doing intervals, you can just say, are you going to punk out like that? And immediately they find that extra gear, right? It may not last long, but they have an extra gear to give and they're willing to give it. Because in their mind, no, I'm not willing to punk out like that. Okay. You can say that to some females, which I have. But by majority, I don't treat them that way. Because if I said that to the, again, generalizing broadly here, but if I say that to majority of the females, are you going to punk out like that? You don't know what type of historical programming they've received. And that could be a switch off for them. That could be a switch that disconnects them from you altogether. But if I say to them, hey, you know you can do this, right? You know you can do this. Now you see the extra gear come on. You see the lights light up. Because what I've just said is I believe in you, even though you don't see it. And they want to see it. But if I say I believe in you, then they're like, well, if he sees it, it must be there. So you understand?
Yeah.
So once you learn, and that's what I call the difference between the art and the science of coaching. You're both doing the same exercise with the same objective, right? But the art is, how do I approach you to get the best out of you? And Eugene, how do I approach you to get the best out of you? That's the art. And understanding that there's a difference between the two and being able to be an artist when you need to be an artist and be a scientist when you need to be a scientist, that's where I think I excel. That's how I'm able to work with a pro tennis player, even though I didn't play tennis. Because the science remains the science, right?
Yeah.
You like a top spin forehand is a top spin forehand. The ball has to be hit from X to Y axis, and therefore it creates rotation and spin. Okay, well, with a racket path, how do you determine where the X to Y axis is? If you understand north and south, you can figure that out. Mm. So then it's, what are you doing idiosyncratically in your movement process that's stopping you from being able to go X to Y consistently? Okay, you can do it while you're standing still. Can you do it while you're on the run? Can you do it while you're moving forward? Can you do it while you're moving backwards? Mm. Science. Mm-hmm. That's all science, right? Mm-hmm. Now, how do I get you from where you are to where we need you to be? That's art. And that's the difference. Also, your level of understanding helps too.
Of course. Yeah. Wow. No, that's incredible. I also want to talk about psychology as well, because I think that's also like a big kind of part of tennis that I don't think a lot of people spend time talking about.
There's a lot, sorry to interrupt, but to give tennis players credit and coaches and their teams, there's a tremendous amount of work being done in that area now, which is phenomenal, especially compared to the way it used to be. Like when McEnroe and those guys were playing,
though,
it was just toughen up, right?
Which is what I'd love to say to players now, to be honest.
Yes. So, sorry to interrupt, I did want to give credit where credit is due, that there are a lot of players and player support personnel looking at that and paying attention to it. Now, whether or not they're executing it properly or not is up for debate.
Yeah.
Not by me.
Yeah.
Because I'm not the first to say you're doing that right or you're doing that wrong. I don't believe there's a right and wrong. I always look at things as, is this appropriate? Is this path that we're on appropriate for the direction that we want to head? That's all.
Because I was just going to say, how have you implemented like the psychology of the sport, or like kind of getting the mind ready for like competition, like in your kind of training with players?
That's a phenomenal question. So, and that's why I'm smiling. So I've said from the beginning, when I opened my first facility, that I use the body to train the mind. So all the physical stuff that we do is a test. And where does the shift, where does the breakdown occur? Where does the light bulb flick on, right? Where does it start to dimmer? Where does it turn off? Where does the power completely disconnect? I see all of that in 20 minutes of a training session. It doesn't matter who you are. Wow. So the little 10-year-old I told you that I started working with, that kind of, you know, springboarded my foray into working with tennis players, Grace Min. Hi, Grace. I had her in the gym. We were doing an exercise, and I put her next to a Division I nose tackle. He was going to play nose tackle for Tulane University. Division I school, big scholarship. He had an outstanding high school career.
So no, nose tackle was American football.
American football, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Forgot where I was. For a minute. So they're doing an exercise side by side. And Grace is probably, I don't know, what would you say, maybe 13, 14 years old? Mm. And he is, you know, 17, 18. Now, couldn't be more of a physical contrast, right? He probably weighs 230 at this point and is, you know, 6'1", okay? And she's tiny. They're doing the same exercise, but it's for time. She's sitting there and she's smiling. We're like 3 minutes in, they have to go 5 minutes. They're 3 minutes in, he's dying, but the ego won't let him stop, right? She's sitting there smiling and laughing. I'm walking by making jokes. He is dying. The exercise is done. He doesn't make it. It takes him 2 attempts. She does it in 1.
Wow.
She gets up and says, okay, Coach John, what's next? He's still writhing around on the floor. That was the first exercise of the entire session. So this went on for roughly 55 minutes more. Okay. Things like this, these scenarios, where basically everything he does, she's doing, but 6 levels better and smiling and enjoying herself. At the end of the session, he limps out. His father calls me later that night. Yeah, I don't think he's going to be able to continue. He says it's not for him.
Wow.
So I said, really? Okay. Here's what, and I hope I'm wrong as I'm talking to his dad. I hope I'm wrong. Here's where his deficiencies are. Right. Here's what's going to happen if he continues doing things the way that he's done. Because once he gets to university, they're just going to do more of that, right? And I listed, you know, 7 or 8 things. And I said, this all puts him in jeopardy of a back problem. And again, I hope I'm wrong. I really like your son. He actually interned for me before he started training. Mm-hmm. It's part of his high school requirement. So he stops training. I'm going to say probably 4 or 5 months later. Now he's at university, preseason training. You know, they're in the weight room and on the field, hard and heavy. His dad calls me up, says, hey, I just found out Andrew's not going to be able to play this season. What happened? He's a good student. Was it academic? No. He fractured a vertebrae in his lower back.
Oh, you cooled it.
He was like, we should have listened to you.
Oh, man.
I said, I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I wish I were wrong, but all the signs. That was that. That he never recovered from that. That ended his football career, lost his scholarship.
That's tough.
Yeah. So those are the types of things that continue to highlight for me the difference between being in a growth mindset and being in a fixed mindset. Mm-hmm. It's easier when you have somebody that wants to please you and you're leading them in the right direction to lead them to a growth mindset environment. So the psychology part, to answer your question, is 95% of what mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. The physical part, that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. Because the body will go where the mind tells it to go.
Yeah.
When the mind tells the body to stop, will stop. Mm-hmm. So if you understand that this general controls the troops, you just have to figure out how to manipulate and use the general properly.
Especially that tennis is so mental.
100%.
Like, I feel like there's so many times some players have probably like lost like such a big match or even like a title, should we say, because of like where their mental
the psychology, yeah.
Like was. Like in my honest opinion, for instance, perfect example, Serena, when she came back from, you know, maternity leave, she was like in 4 Grand Slams.
Mm-hmm.
She had the, obviously she's not moving as she was before due to age, due to, you know, her being a mom. But I've always felt like the main reason why she couldn't get it was the pressure and the thinking, like her mental was just like, it was just too much like going on, which she kind of admitted herself anyways afterwards. So yeah, in our sport, definitely counts like a lot in general.
No, 100%. I don't know if there's anything you want to add on that. Like,
I do. Love Serena. Nothing but utmost respect for her and her accomplishment, both on and off the court.
Mm-hmm.
Huge moves on the financial side. So it's amazing.
Both, Serena Ventures.
Yeah, both her and Venus. Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But what probably caused the most amount of difficulty for her was the same thing that most players are plagued with, even though they don't have her record of success, living in the past.
Mm.
From practice to practice, I've had many, many issues where I've seen a player go out and they'll have a practice session, whether it be a pre-match warm-up or, you know, a practice session the day before their match.
Mm.
And they look pissed off, disgruntled, you know, you name it, whatever it is. And when you peel back the layers and you figure out why, well, I'm not hitting the same as I was yesterday. Okay. But that was yesterday.
Mm.
This is today. This is how you're hitting today.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you chasing a feeling? Because feelings change from moment to moment. So why are you chasing a feeling that you don't even have now? You didn't have a minute ago. You had it yesterday. There are so many variables that change between now and then, but you're still living in the past, but you're trying to project into the future. That doesn't even logically make sense.
Mm.
Why don't you just say, here is what I'm dealing with today. Let me figure out how to deal with this challenge right now. Because when you're in a match, are you going to be thinking about how you hit yesterday or the challenge that you're faced with right now? Look at Medvedev's yesterday in his match. Mm. Chris was playing out of his mind, right? Mm-hmm. Medvedev could have said, the last time I, you know, my last match, I was playing out of my mind. Mm. Let me try and get that feeling back. No, that's a recipe for loss immediately. It would have been over quick, straight set victory to Eubanks. But what he did say was, no, here's what he's doing well. What can I do well? Well, I can hold serve. Okay, so I know I'm going to win my service games. I will not allow myself to be broken anymore. If I get some lucky returns on his service games, I can put some pressure on him. Blah, 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 blah. And I didn't talk to Daniil, but I imagine this is what he was thinking. The point is, he was in the moment. You saw him on his changeover, and you could tell he was focusing on what do I need to do now? Where are the solutions right now? And identifying them and then locking them in. And when I talked to Taylor, we call that setting the program and just hitting enter. You set the program and you hit enter, and then you go play. Let the program run out. Don't try to write code as you're chasing the ball, right? It's not going to work. It already needs to be there. And it can't be what happened before. Even one set before, one game before, there's too much in the past. So when you deal with someone like a Serena, who's coming back from this monumental thing, right? She had a child. She's got this huge weight of expectation that everyone else is putting on her. She chooses to adopt that. But she can also choose, just like we can all choose, to reject that. I'm not carrying any additional weight. How I play today is how I play today. Forget about what I've done. Forget about what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to play my best tennis right now. What do I need to do in order to do that? And that's just what I call clarity. When you're clear on that, the other things start to fall away. So now getting tight on big points, why would you get tight? If you're thinking about what you need to do in that moment, then you're clear on purpose and focus. You're not thinking about there's no weight of the moment. This is one of the things that I think Novak does better than anyone else in the game. His clarity in the moments are huge.
That's a good point.
And that's why he is where he is right now. That's why he's separated himself on several levels, in my opinion.
I didn't really think of it like that, but that definitely makes sense, to be honest.
Clarity, that's the key word there. Slightly left of field question, John, now. So one of the reasons why, obviously, our platform is obviously centered around celebrating Black figures in the game. And I think I'm pretty sure we said it to you guys last year when we interviewed you and Taylor, like how it's powerful seeing you in her box as her coach, obviously a Black man, you know, coaching a Black player. Like, clearly there's a lack of that in the game. Well, there aren't many Black players in general.
Right.
But do you feel there's this particular reason why you don't see many Black coaches, like, in pro tennis?
That's a great question. One, admittedly, that I have not thought about.
I did say left the field.
It's perfectly fine. But I think, so when you ask me that question, the first thing I think about is, let me look at other industries and see if there's a reason why there's a lack of, you know, color in certain positions. We look in politics, is there a lack of color there? If we look in business, is there a lack of color there? If we look in, you know, billionaire, you know, echelon, is there a lack of color there? To be honest, I can't think of a situation that would lead me to say that there's a specific reason that there are not more of us there. Other than more of us have not decided that this is where we want to be. And that's the answer that I would apply all across the board in those other scenarios that I mentioned. If you're not in the room, it's because you either decided you don't want to be in that room, or you haven't created a room of your own. So for me, like, and I don't know if you guys have seen this movie, but the movie Divergent, I'm going to go left of field.
Okay. Yes.
But
it's been a while since I watched it. But
it's been a while. Yeah. So when I saw that movie, I immediately identified, and it made complete sense to me because I'm divergent. And I think everyone who has been a earth mover, a disruptor, is divergent at their core. They just say, okay, I'm supposed to go this way because I'm supposed to end up there. But what if I go this way instead? What if I go that way instead? They ask the question. And I don't think that enough of us ask the question. We could say it's because there aren't enough opportunities. Well, if you separate yourself from everybody else, do the opportunities find you, or are there no opportunities? Because someone's in the role, right? Someone's in the role. My role with there's a reason that Taylor doesn't have a separate nutritionist. There's a reason that Taylor doesn't have a separate physio. And she does, credit to Ron. What's up, Ron? Who steps in and gratefully relieves one of my roles and responsibilities, right? But there's a reason that she doesn't need that full time. It's because I've leveled up. I've worked hard and still work hard on improving my skill set. Now, if I stopped, then I create a gap, right? A gap, a space for someone else to slide in. Well, if we're not in these roles, why are we not in these roles? Is it because the roles don't exist? Well, we know that that's not true because, like I said, someone's sitting in the seat. So maybe we just haven't done enough to level ourselves up and make ourselves exceptional, that it would be silly not to have that person in this spot. Brian Shelton. Shout out to Brian and Ben.
And Ben, indeed.
Yeah. But perfect example. So, and I've never seen Brian coach. So I can't speak to his tennis acumen at all. But I looked at the product. And how can you argue, right?
And he played as well. He's a former pro. So, yeah.
You look at the, I mean, we both know, though, that just because you do it doesn't mean you can teach
true,
it.
True. Fact.
So, and that's in any domain.
Any domain, yeah.
So for him to be able to bridge that gap successfully is a statement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 100%.
And then you look at his results at Georgia. You look at his CV, as little of it as I know. But I met Brian when he was at Tech. And he left. I was still there in Atlanta. So I didn't follow his career in Florida, but obviously they've had some success,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So there must have been something going on. To me, he's leveled himself up. And again, I can't speak to his philosophy as a coach. I don't know anything about that. I'm completely ignorant as to the details. I'm looking from a 15,000 foot view and I'm saying, this guy has separated himself. What did he do to separate himself? I don't know, but he's done it. And he's created a lane for himself. If the lane didn't exist, he created one. If the lane existed, but the standard of the people in it were so low, he just rose above. Well, where's the limitation then? It's not external. It's internal. Because somebody, to be honest with you, if I were a young tennis coach right now, and I couldn't find any traction in the US, I'd leave.
Because that's going to be my last question as well. What would be your kind of advice to a young person that clearly won't make it pro, but they want to like go into coaching and
potentially coach at the highest level, like what would your advice be to say person?
That's a super simple question for me right now, because I've said this to like six guys that in the last year, dude, very easy. What's the number one commodity that every top player needs, but it's hard to find? A good hitter. So if you can't connect with a top player, because there's usually a network there, right? Mm-hmm. Their coach knows somebody mm-hmm. that would fill that role. Okay. So let's remove the top player. What about the level down? The guys that are just starting to come on tour. They may not be able to pay you, but that's not what you're doing.
Yeah.
What you're doing is putting yourself in an environment where you can demonstrate value. Okay? What about, if you're a guy, what about hitting for some players on the WTA? Mm. Why would that not be a good thing? If you want to coach, do you only want to coach guys or do you want to coach girls as well? Well, if you don't care, you just want to work with a top, like your aspiration is to work with a top player, then go where there's a space for you to fit in, get into the space, provide value. No, where you start is not where you want to end up. But when Jeff Bezos was sitting in that cubicle, he had dreams of Amazon on his wall, right? It hadn't been founded yet. That was just where he was at the time. Mm. And he used that time to learn, grow, and figure out how to bring more value to the marketplace. Jim Rohn said, you don't get paid for what you do. You get paid based on the value you bring to the marketplace. So if you bring more value, you'll get rewarded for it. Mm-hmm. And if you're not getting rewarded for it in the market that you're in, find another market. So, yes, get started there. Start linking up with some juniors that you think may have some potential. Start coaching for free. Maybe you don't do, it's not a full-time job. You still need to eat, I'm saying.
Yeah.
But you learn, you hone your skill. You start to understand the difference between the art and science. You work on your communication skills, your ability to convey information, large amounts of information in a short period of time. You understand how humans learn and you become better at teaching. Mm-hmm. Now, any domain you go into, that's going to be valuable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you continue working on your skill while you are putting yourself in that environment. Now, everybody has, be impeccable with your word. Demonstrate yourself as a true professional, even though you're not in a professional environment, so that anybody who comes in contact with you has only good things to say about you, even if they don't know you. I don't know him. But me talking about Brian, I do know him. But we haven't we haven't sat down and had a meal together. He hasn't been to my house.
Mm-hmm.
I know him through seeing him, through our encounter. I chatted with him at Wimbledon and his family. He seems like a really nice guy. And I have the utmost respect for the things he's done vis-a-vis his, demonstration of skill, expertise, and parenting with Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Ben's a great kid.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hang out. But I look from a distance, you see his energy, you see his smile. He's a good kid.
He is.
That didn't come from nowhere.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So my point is, I don't know Brian, but I have nothing but good things to say about him.
Mm.
He carried himself like a professional when I met him and he was at Tech. He carries himself like a professional when I met him, reconnected with him a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know him, but I have that to say about him.
Yeah.
How bad is that?
Yeah.
So you put yourself in an environment where people can react and interact with you on that level. And then you just put in the work. You put your head down. You dedicate yourself to doing those things and opportunities will find you.
Love that. It's a brilliant way to end it.
Honestly.
Man. Thank you, John, man. That, that was incredible.
Much. That was, I feel like every time you talk to John, you're just like, damn, I got to sit down and think about my life.
No, it was beautiful. Oh, I just loved everything you said. Like from the detail you gave and the analysis, and you have such good insight. So I hope that comes across. I'm sure it did come across in the interview.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, thanks for your time, John. Because yeah, I know my pleasure, man.
You got a flight to catch. Yeah. Time to get ready for hard court and probably the best slam ever. I didn't really say that, but chill. Yeah.
we're still in Wimbledon time. Relax.
Well, actually, what's your favorite slam? Quickly.
My favorite slam.
Be honest.
This is a safe space.
Okay. I really love the Australian Open.
Okay.
Everybody says that.
I've been there twice.
Okay.
The efficiency in how they operate, unmatched so far this year.
Okay.
The app, the interaction, I mean, next level. The French Open did a great job at leveling up this year. But I'm from New York. So if I had to pick one, it would be super tough, but I'd probably say the US
Open. Fine.
And there we go. There we have it. And we can close it there.
And that's because the energy in New York is also unmatched. Oh, yeah. It's unmatched. Also, you know, history being around Arthur Ashe and that whole, like, Althea Gibson, like, just the vibe.
Yeah.
God willing, we're there next year.
Yes.
Guys, BSG. Pray for us.
We will.
But no, John, again, thank you so much, man.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for having me. I deeply appreciated it.
And yeah, guys, hope you enjoyed the episode and we will catch you on the next one. We don't know when yet, but
yeah.
We'll let you know on the socials. But yeah, guys, thanks for tuning in and until next time.